I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. I'm Duncan Ferguson. I will be your worship associate this morning. Our minister, the Reverend Lisa Day, will be our worship leader. Our choir is on summer break. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we are working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We welcome the presence and participation of people of all races, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you on YouTube and here on site, whoever you know yourself to be and wherever you are on your journey. With the lighting of our chalice, symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into sacred time. As we kindle this flame, may it spark in each of us connection and commitment to this living tradition and to each other. May it serve to give us clarity of purpose and illuminate our way as we set about doing the work of this congregation in commitment, in cooperation, and in love today and in the months and years ahead.
Wind that whispers through the live oak trees, sun that sustains us, water that washes over willing earth and weathered stones, a smile shared and savored, a child's squeal of delight as they dance, the quiet joy of gathered community. This is the spirit of life and love that we call forth now into this gathering. May this spirit infuse our hearts, fill our souls, and carry us forward like a wave on the ocean as we enter now into this sacred time and place. Let us worship together. Our first reading this morning from 20th century theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime, therefore we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history, therefore we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. Facebook post from 21st century writer Rebecca Solnit. Got up, made tea, looked at all the ugly out there. It's there. So is this trail, no wider than a dinner plate drawn like a pencil line along the curving western flanks of Mount Tamalpais, a trail that yesterday kept pointing me toward the infinite, the beyond, the deep blue where the sea merged with the sky, but the trail also kept bending to the left, so I never stepped into it, but kept on wandering and drinking in the beauty and the vastness and the quiet, feet upon the solid ground, eyes in the sublime, with passages through shady groves, moments when even the shadows of the grasses were beautiful. sightings of bluebells, lizards, scrapes of late lupins and poppies like scattered jewels in the grass. The mountain, the sea, the sky was there before us and will be there after us, and in the meantime, we get to choose our paths. And finally, from Unitarian Universalist Minister Lynn Unger, unconcerned. Of course I share your fear, your frustration, the desperate urge to somehow wrest the train back onto the tracks. But this morning I noticed that the deer are profoundly unconcerned, quietly munching through the graveyard. The ferns and the salal could not be less worried, and the madrones are not losing any bark over it. The birds are yelling about what tree belongs to whom, but no guns or bombs are in the picture. The water is not even ruffled, and the mountains, with or without an icing of snow, are entirely at peace. The sky is persistently blue for reasons I have never understood and continues stretching beyond the edge of what I can imagine. Beneath granite markers holding names and dates and military service, the dead are entirely quiet. Nothing is fixed, says Baldwin in his wisdom. Nothing is fixed in place, nothing is resolved, nothing has reached its inevitable conclusion. Unhurried, the deer head off into the forest. I ended last week's sermon with these words. These times call us to heed the lessons of the cycle of Earth's seasons, each in its own time. Let us be eager and unwavering in our pursuit of nature's, of the remedies of nature's way may teach us. Fearless and joyful in turning our learning into action for the transformation and salvation of the world. This week, I'm still pondering what we might and probably should learn from nature. I'm also struggling a bit, wondering if there are limits to the lessons we can draw and the ways we can and should emulate nature's way. You see, a member of one of my previous congregations was a biology professor. From time to time, I'd declare life is precious, from the pulpit, and during coffee hour, he'd always counter with, "Life is cheap." Theologian versus biologist repartee. I was right, and he was right. Life is sacred, miraculous, too precious to be squandered or pushed to the edges of humanity's realm of concern. And life is cheap. The earth is teeming with life, more species and in greater numbers than the layperson or even all the biologists in the world can know. Thinking about those exchanges reminds me that our perspectives matter. Whatever perspective we bring to the consideration of an object, an event, a situation, the totality of our culture, education, faith tradition, gender, life experience, profession, that perspective matters. Theologian and biologist, engineer and painter, prison guard and chaplain, classroom teacher, parent, administrator, even when we focus on the same topic or object or situation, our conclusions, our convictions, our actions may vary wildly from one from the other without either being the one and only right way. Life is precious and cheap. The Eiffel Tower is a feat of engineering and an endless source of artistic inspiration. An incarcerated person may have been convicted of a crime, though not always, and has inherent worth and dignity, full stop. A story may further a teacher's goal of a welcoming and inclusive classroom and undermine a parent's attempt to raise their child in accordance with their belief system, and threaten an administrator's desire to make it through the year without a lawsuit. This last example is tricky because as Unitarian Universalists, we have pretty firm convictions about censorship and book banning, and many of us are itching for a fight about bigotry versus faith. But that doesn't change the core argument. Perspective matters even and perhaps especially when we don't want to consider any perspective other than our own. This week, reflecting back on those life is precious, life is cheap exchanges also reminded me that though we are a part of the interconnected web of all existence, a part of life, our human development and consequent behaviors and actions over millennia have set us apart from the rest of the interdependent, interconnected web of all existence in many and not insignificant ways. The paradox that we are simultaneously a part of the web and apart from the web is an illusion. Yet it is an illusion we dwell within and operate from. And it suggests to me that our attempts to draw wisdom from the natural world and to try to model our lives and actions on it might not always serve our best intentions or the best interests of the world. Or rather, that we would do well to at least temper our emulation of nature with a measure of caution. Consider my colleague's lovely poem, Unconcerned. I've gone round and round with this poem ever since she posted it a few weeks ago and I reprinted it in our August newsletter. I want it to be as true and wise as it is lovely. The deer are profoundly unconcerned, quietly munching. The ferns and the salal could not be less worried, and the madrones are not losing any bark over it. The water is not even ruffled, and the mountains are entirely at peace. My soul recognizes the beauty and power in those images and believes there is truth in Reverend Unger's words, yet my mind protests. Yes, but we're not birds or ferns or deer. Not water or mountain. We come by our concern, our profound concern, honestly. We know what we collectively have done to one another and our planet. It's one thing for the deer to head unhurriedly into the forest. It may be tempting even for us to head into a forest or other wilderness too. But the forest and the wetlands and the prairies that haven't already disappeared at our hands are even now dying at our hands. We are part of the natural world, our earth home, and we are apart from it. And it is mostly our inability, our refusal to fully accept our place within it that drives our false sense that we are separate from it and then allows us to destroy it. The same is true of that smaller portion of the interconnected web of all existence, the portion that is the interconnected web of all humanity, described by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as an inescapable network of mutuality. We, whoever we are as individuals, as societies, as classes, or genders, or citizens of a particular country, we, driven by fear or the lie of scarcity or ages-old prejudices, we set ourselves apart from the rest of the web of humanity over and over again. And it is our inability to fully comprehend that we are tied in a single garment of destiny that allows us to cause harm to other parts of the network, seldom realizing that because whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly, we are causing harm to ourselves as well. Walking unhurriedly into the forest is fine for the deer, but the human landscape is too big a mess we made of it, littered with forgotten, starving people, failing small businesses, under-resourced public schools, war-torn and occupied lands. We can't just walk unconcerned along a path towards safety or food or whatever it is the forest holds for the deer. We can't. We can't. I've been arguing with myself and the poet all week that that lesson from nature is a lesson too far. Perhaps I was wrong last week. Perhaps these times don't call for us to follow nature's way. Perhaps now is the time for us to look for guidance elsewhere, like Star Trek. Perhaps if we're going to rest the train of democracy and decency back onto the track, we have to lock in a course that will allow us to stop the harm, repair the breach, heal our world, the inescapable network of mutuality and the interdependent web of all existence. Even as my internal argument with Lynn's poem was raging, I heard B.A. Parker of NPR's Code Switch interview Gloria J. Brown Marshall, author of A Protest History of the United States, published, by the way, by our own Unitarian Universalist publishing house, Beacon Press. I recommend the interview and reading the book, though I have not yet. Professor Brown Marshall highlights the difference between what she calls TV protests and real-life protests. In television or the movies, think Selma, for example, there is a problem, a couple planning meetings, an unsuccessful first protest, a dark night of the soul, then a second protest that is victorious and resolves the unjust situation. A vastly condensed and oversimplified timeline. In real life, the Montgomery bus boycott began on December 5th, 1955, and didn't end until December 20th, 1956, more than a year later. And the Civil Rights Act wasn't enacted for another 9 years after that, the Voting Rights Act not until the year after that. Similarly, though President Grant issued a proclamation in 1869 regarding an 8-hour workday, most workers in the United States did not benefit from it until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Protest, successful lasting social change, is a long game, long and costly. Requiring laser focus, unwavering commitment, eyes on the prize, and hands to the work. Perhaps, I came to believe, the only wisdom in Reverend Unger's poem lies in the lines that have nothing to do with the serenity of the deer and the birds, the mountains, and the water. Nothing is fixed, says Baldwin in his wisdom. Nothing is fixed in place, nothing is resolved, nothing has reached its inevitable conclusion. There is truth there when I don't get distracted or misdirected by the deer. The forgotten, starving people, failing small businesses, under-resourced public schools, war-torn and occupied lands, none of this is fixed in place, nor has any of it reached its inevitable conclusion. This observation echoes the words of Reinhold Niebuhr we heard earlier. It also harkens back to Eleanor Gordon, one of the Iowa Sisterhood of late 19th century, early 20th century female Unitarian and Universalist ministers. Gordon preached about what she called the glory of the imperfect, the unfinished and flawed nature of the universe that allows us to be co-creators with God. Epiphany time. When I looked away from those unconcerned, unhurried deer for a moment, I understood their lesson for us, for me anyway. Because nothing is resolved, we are allowed to be, if not unhurried and totally unconcerned, then at least less frantic and more deliberate in our course. The mess we've made of our human landscape and the natural landscape will be here tomorrow and next year and well beyond. Yes, we have to stop the harm, repair the breach, and heal our world, the inescapable network of mutuality and the interdependent web of all existence. But we don't have to complete this task this afternoon, and probably won't complete it in this lifetime, and certainly won't complete it alone. Yet if we attend to the task with deliberation and a minimum of frenetic, unfocused energy, we'll survive for the long game. And if we attend steadfastly to the long game in our time, with our personal and communal capacity, we will be saved by hope and faith and love. Rebecca Solnit, in this morning's second reading, doesn't tell us what made the well-worn paths the width of a dinner plate she followed toward but not to infinity. For a time, I imagined them to be left by mountain bike tires, dozens of bikers creating and following a course over time. And then I imagined them as deer paths or the tracks of other creatures, the tall grasses worn away over decades of walking the shortest, safest path to food sources and watering holes and hiding places. There are well-worn paths through our landscape, too, leading us to sustenance and safety and restoration in our proper place in the web. Theologians such as Niebuhr trod some of them before us. Preachers and social reformers such as Eleanor Gordon trod some of them. Others have been left to us by protesters, artists, musicians, visionaries of bygone eras. Poets such as Lynn Unger tread some of them. And some are even now being blazed through unnavigated terrain by young leaders, as if on so many speeding mountain bikes, who see the situation and the way forward with a clarity of perspective we can't possibly comprehend, but that is full of possibility for precisely the reason that it is beyond our comprehension. So many paths forward toward stopping the harm, repairing the breach, and healing our world. While the enormity of the task calls for our unwavering commitment, we need not, after all, lock course on a single path, but rather follow the way until it doesn't lead forward any longer, and then follow another way, sometimes in solitude, sometimes in community, trusting that together we will someday arrive at the infinite. And it will be vast and beautiful, abundant and serene for all. Amen.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.